Thanks for tuning in to Women in Product Marketing. I'm your host, Mary Sheehan with Adobe. For those of you that are new to the pod, we explore the world of product marketing through the lens of the women who run it at some of the fastest growing technology companies in the world. All right, let's do this.
Welcome back to Women in Product Marketing. I'm your host, Mary Sheehan. I am thrilled to kick off season 6 with April Dunford, the author of Obviously Awesome and Sales Pitch. April is the world expert in B2B positioning, as well as the founder and CEO of Ambient Strategy, a positioning consulting firm. She's also the host of a new top-rated podcast called Positioning with April Dunford, and has a newsletter with almost 20,000 subscribers. I've personally been wanting to interview April since we started the show. Thank you so much for being on the show today with us, April.
Hey, this is so great. I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's start with our opening question. Can you take us back to a moment in your career or your life where you had to step outside of your comfort zone? What was it like?
Yeah, so I've had a lot of moments where I had to step outside of my comfort zone. I would say most of the good things that have happened to me in my career have been a result of me kind of stepping out of my comfort zone. But one that happened really early in my career is I was working in product marketing for a company that got acquired. And after the acquisition, there was a bit of confusion about who was going to report to who and how the whole thing was going to get organized, as happens after acquisitions. And my boss quit. And there was nobody to kind of run the marketing group. And they sort of looked around and said, you're it.
Been there.
And they put me in charge of the team. Now, the hilarious thing about this was that I didn't study marketing in school. I studied engineering. And I am about a year and a half out of an engineering degree. And they put me in charge of the marketing team. And not only that, I had a great big budget. There was an internal contest for some money and I won it. And so we had the normal budget plus we had this extra $1 million. And this was a long time ago. So $1 million was a lot of money. And then I had this great big team and I had never managed a team before. And my first thought was like, you know how some people talk about you have imposter syndrome? I was like, I don't have imposter syndrome. I am the imposter. There is nothing, you know, I have no qualifications for this job. I don't know anything about marketing. I don't know anything about managing a team. I don't know anything about anything. But I decided, well, one of two things is going to happen. Like, if I crash and burn at this thing, they'll probably just fire me. Or maybe I figure out a way to make this thing work. And if I could make it work for a couple of years, and these were the time horizons I was always looking at because we had been acquired. So I think I had a 2-year earnout after the acquisition. It takes 2 years for you to get all your stock options out and all that. So they had a retention thing on. So I thought, well, if I could just make it to the 2 years, then I'll get all my money. And now I've got this big title on my resume. This will be great. So my whole thing was, how do I not get fired in 2 years? Two things I did there. So one was I spent a lot of time with my team. So I had a bunch of very senior people on my team. And the first thing I worried about was, why didn't those senior people get the job instead of me? And it turned out I was very lucky in that the senior folks on the team didn't want the job. Mm. So the great thing about that was they were actually personally invested in making me successful because they were worried if I got fired, they were going to make them the boss and they didn't want to be the boss. So I had some senior people that were very comfortable in individual contributor roles that were kind of invested in making me successful. So I leaned on them a lot in terms of, what do you think I should be doing here right now? You know, we got this thing going on. What do you think? And so that was super helpful. The second thing was that I had this boss and he didn't know too much about marketing, thank God, because otherwise he wouldn't have put me in the job. But he didn't know too much about marketing. And I thought the key to having a good relationship with this guy was going to be over communication so that I couldn't step in it too deep. Mm-hmm. Before the guy noticed and said, wait, hang on a sec, you shouldn't be doing that. So I had very regular communication with this person and, in my opinion, over communicated with him. So I didn't do anything without running it by him 15 ways, making sure he really understood what was going on, making sure his expectations were always set. So we did a lot of things that were really experimental. Like, we're going to run an experiment running this campaign in a channel we've never touched before and whatever. And so I made sure that his expectations were always really low. Like, we're going to throw some money at this dude and it's probably not going to work. Are you okay with that? Because, you know, it's probably not going to work. So I always had his expectations really low. Occasionally we'd sail over them and they'd think I'm doing a great job.
Amazing.
And so anyways, that was a great experience in that I didn't know the job. I knew I shouldn't have had the job, but I kind of made it work for a couple of years. And then I ended up quitting and going back to a smaller company after my earnout was out. But then I had the title and that was it. You never go back.
Totally.
And at that point I was like, this is what I do. This is my thing. But I had to really lean into that job and just say, oh, you want me to be this? Okay, I'm just going to fake it till I make it, I guess. But I learned a lot about trusting your team, managing your team, managing all the way down while simultaneously managing up to make sure that the boss's expectations are set. They're not getting surprised with bad news ever. They know exactly what I'm doing and they can help me to avoid doing really stupid things.
Well, this is already gold. Yeah, in less than 5 minutes, you've covered three major themes that we talk about on our podcast.
Oh, really?
Managing up. You've talked about imposter syndrome and also mentorship, leaning into those relationships that you could have. So I love
that. Yeah. Like, and again, like people ask me a lot, like, haven't you ever had an imposter syndrome? I'm like, no, I have been the imposter. Like, it wasn't like I was undervaluing my skills. I had no skills.
Like, engineer.
There's no skills to undervalue. I literally couldn't spell marketing. Like, I was so junior. I was literally a kid. Like, that's the people on my team were like, yeah, we couldn't believe it when they gave the job to you, but you know, good luck, Chuck.
I love it. Well, anyways, walk us through today now. So you have a consulting business. You are the CEO and founder of your own consulting business.
Sounds good, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. I think it's a fantasy for a lot of people in product marketing. Oh, I want to have a consulting business. Is it all cracked up to be? Tell us more.
Oh, it's way harder than you think. Yeah. Like, I think I moved through the stages just like the way a lot of people do that have had long careers in tech and then they decide to switch to consulting. So I did 25 years, repeat vice president of marketing, whole bunch of startups, 6 acquisitions, like 17 product launches. And then after I was coming out of the last one, I was looking in the mirror, having this conversation with myself, like, April, really, are we going to go do this again? We're going to go do this again? Are we? Are we going to do something different? And the last job I had was a stinker. Like, it was bad. It was, you know, the founder was a bad dude. I had a contract that got broken. And in a pretty illegal sort of a way. Like, so I came out of the last one and it wasn't a joyous experience. And I had put a lot of effort into it. Like, it was, I felt like I had done some of my career's best work and didn't get any reward for it. And it ended kind of badly. And so I thought, you know what? Maybe I'm done with this. Like, maybe I got to go do something else. So, like everybody else, I'm like, maybe I'll just go be a consultant. And so I started the way most people start. Like, I know a lot of things about marketing. I've been the VP for a long time. There's lots of things I could go do. I'll just hang up my shingle and say VP marketing for hire. So what today everyone would call a fractional VP marketing. And easy to get clients, but it was the wrong kind of clients. So what happened is clients come to me and what they really want is they just want to hire me to be the VP marketing. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows me as that. And I say, oh, look, I don't do that anymore. I do this fractional thing. So it's going to be you plus 3 or 4 other clients. And here's what I charge and whatever. And they're like, okay, but you're going to love us. You're going to love us so much. You're going to change your mind and come to work for us. And so these jobs were stupid. There was no real project there. They were basically just trying to convince me to come and work as the VP marketing. In mm-hmm. some cases, they just assumed I was the VP marketing. I'm just the 2-day a week VP marketing. So the expectations were full-time output, like the same expectations they would have for a full-time VP marketing, except they're paying me part-time wages. Yeah. And then this is the other thing I learned is people can do math just like anyone else. So they're like, okay, we know what a VP marketing costs. You're here 1 day a week. We're going to do VP marketing divided by 5. And that's what we pay you. And I'm like, well, hang on. I got overhead. I got this. I'm not fully booked all the time. That's not the way it works. But they were like, nobody could understand why that wouldn't be the rate. So that was bad. So very quickly I was like, okay, this sucks. Oh, the other thing from a positioning standpoint, it's terrible positioning. Like, you're now competing with everybody else that just came out of their VP marketing job, like rock stars coming out of Facebook and Google and stuff. And now you're competing with them too. And what do you got that's any different? Nothing. Yep. So I thought, okay, I need to fix this. So I decided, well, I'm going to have to focus on a niche area and then focus in on that. And the key to good positioning, not just as a consultant, but as anything, is to pick something where you think, I could credibly become the best in the world at this. I could draw a little box around it and say, I'm the best in the world. There's nobody else you could hire that would be better at this thing than me. And so I sat down and thought about it. And positioning is something that I'd done a lot of in my career. And in the later part of my career, people hired me because I could talk intelligently about positioning. I had a bit of a methodology that I used in the last couple of companies that I worked for. And I thought, okay, so positioning's my thing. But then it took me about a year, maybe 2 years, to figure out how to make that into an offering. I knew how to do it if I was your VP marketing. I didn't know how to do it as a consulting engagement, where there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. What's the deliverable? How do we get to the deliverable? What are the steps in the middle? So it took me a long time of messing around a bit with a handful of clients before I figured out, you know, this is actually an exercise, a facilitated exercise with a cross-functional team, where I come with the methodology and I'm the facilitator and we're working through positioning together. At the beginning, I thought it was going to be this big, long engagement. It turns out I can actually do that in 3 days. So what I ended up with after 2 years of flailing around was, there's this 3-day engagement. I come in as the facilitator, where, you know, we get a cross-functional team together. By the end of the engagement, we've got this positioning done and it's great. And then I messed around a lot with the pricing, like at the beginning. Oh, and then coming back to the positioning, the other thing is, my methodology was built in the companies that I worked with, which were all B2B. And so it became clear to me that I was going to have to go even nichier than that, because I don't think this thing works in consumer the same way it does in B2B. Right. So I was saying no to all the consumer businesses. And then a big part of what we're doing in this workshop is, we're taking the positioning and we're translating it into a sales pitch. If you don't have salespeople, you don't care about that part. And there's other problems if you don't have a sales team. So I was eliminating everybody that had a zero touch sales model. So my niche got really... my box is very small. It's your B2B tech company. At the beginning, I was only doing companies that were Series A, Series B. Now I do lots of big companies. But back then, just early stage with a sales team, like, there's a long list of... But by the end of a year or two of doing that, I could credibly say, I don't think there's anyone on the planet that has done more early stage B2B tech companies with a sales team positioning than I have.
I love
it. So this enabled me to put my rates up. You know, at the beginning, I was doing a workshop and charging people $5,000, and then it was 10, and then it was 20, and now it's a lot more than that.
Well, I love that you have this descriptor of the world's leading expert of B2B product positioning, and you can really definitively say that. But thank you also for sharing the journey. I think people that know you and have seen your career, I think you just woke up out of one day and you wrote 2 books and had this booming business. It's nice to hear that it was flailing a little bit.
No, like it was totally. Yeah, I do. And people call me and they think that, oh, well, you were just the VP marketing and then you just stepped into this thing. I'm like, dude, there was 3 years of thrashing around. I didn't know what I was doing. And it wasn't just like, oh, I'll put up the shingle and everything's perfect. Like, not at all. It took me a long time to figure out the offering, long time to figure out the pricing. And then that's the beginning, right? Then you have to actually go build pipeline. Like, you gotta, how are people gonna know that I exist? How are people gonna, and even worse than that, I'm selling positioning. Like, 9 out of 10 clients that I work with, they don't even know what positioning is until I tell them. So how do I solve that problem? And so that's where things like, well, I can solve the problem of waking them up to what is positioning in a conference talk or in a book or in articles or in stuff on social media. And so all of that stuff is in service to that. So my marketing is deliberately aimed at helping people that have the problem recognize it. And then they got to know to call me. Mm-hmm. It's not as easy as it looks. Everybody thinks it's... But that said, it's the greatest work I've ever done. Like, this is like this phase of my career feels like, you know, now that I got it all figured out, it feels like the reward phase of my career. Like, you know, there was all this struggle and pain that happened, you know, working in little underfunded startups for 30 years. And now this is the part of my career where I get to just stay in my zone of excellence. I'm doing the best work of my career with really great companies, getting paid fair money for that. Like, that's pretty cool.
It feels like you're having fun doing it too. Does that
Yeah. Like, it is fun, right?
Like, you love your job right now.
It's fun doing amazing work. Like, you don't always get the opportunity to do your amazing work. Totally. And it's not usually your fault, right? The company's failing. The product's no good. The team is all dysfunctional. Like, you can be the world's most amazing marketer and be inside a company and not be doing your best work because, you know, none of the other stuff is working. But it's pretty fun to be, like, in this consulting business. I'm just me. I'm solo. There's nobody else. So it's just me. I'm lucky in that I've been doing this long enough now and people know me and I've done a decent job marketing myself. I've got a reasonable pipeline. I can be fairly picky about who I work with. So I only work with folks where I think, yeah, we're really going to do a good bit of work together. And so I'm doing my best work. My clients are super happy. I'm getting paid decent money to do it. Like, that's it, man. That's the dream right there.
That's so amazing. Well, going back a little bit to when April was becoming the queen of positioning, you wrote this really great article that I'll link in the show notes. It's called The Primer on Positioning. And it talks about how you really got obsessed with positioning in talking to 100 clients. And I think that if I'm remembering this correctly, 94 out of them hated your product, with 6 were diehard. So can you share a little bit more about that journey and that experience?
Yeah. So my first ever job in marketing, I got hired as the product marketer on a product that was failing. And, you know, because I'm the new gal, so they put me on the bad product that was failing. And the original idea of this product was, it was going to be kind of like desktop productivity software. Like, they saw it as competing with Excel, except it did a lot of things that databases, like at the time, traditional relational databases did. So you could write a SQL query and run it, but you could do it just like a spreadsheet where you could run on your laptop. And, you know, at the time, databases were these big, complicated things. You needed servers to run them and people to maintain them and all this stuff. So we had this idea, and the guys that built the product were smart guys. They were in market with a bunch of compiler products. And so they had done good customer discovery. They talked to their customers. Customers really seemed interested in this thing. They built it, they launched it, and then nobody bought it. Mm-hmm. So they sold like 200 copies of this thing for $100 a pop. And they thought they were going to sell 200,000 copies of this thing. Like, so the thing's a disaster. I get this job. And so the first thing they gave me to do was, they said, look, we're thinking we might kill it, but we don't know, because it's on-prem software. We don't know whether people are using it or not. So we want you to call everybody. Here's the spreadsheet of all 200. We want you to call everybody and find out, are they using it or not? And if they are, what are they doing with it? And basically what we want you to find out, are they going to cry when we sunset it and we tell them we're not going to support it anymore? So the users of this thing were developers. So that in itself was quite hilarious, trying to get a developer to talk to you on the phone. Very funny. Like, no developer wants to talk to anybody, let alone on the phone. So I'm calling and calling. Nobody's responding. But eventually I came up with this whole shtick. This is my damsel in distress shtick. Worked really well. I would call and leave the message that was like, look, I'm new. I work at this company and they're going to fire me if you don't talk to me.
And it worked.
Which I maybe thought was true at the time. I don't know. But it totally worked. And then I'd call them back and then they'd pick up. Anyway, so out of the 200, I talked to 100. And so here's how it went. The first 20 I talked to, I get them on the phone. I'm like, hey, I'm calling from this company. You bought this thing. And they're like, no, we didn't. And I'm like, what are you? Yeah, you did. I got the spreadsheet here on such and such a date. You went to the website, you paid $100, you got it. And they're like, oh, that thing. Yeah. You know, it sounded cool. You know, we downloaded it, we looked at it, but we couldn't really figure out what to do with it. We're not using it at all. I'm like, 20 calls in a row like this, 20 calls. We didn't even know we had it. So I'm like, okay, we're going to sunset this, no problem. But then I got call 21. So 21, I get the guy on the phone and the guy's like, oh my God, I'm so glad you called. He's like, you guys make me look so smart at the office. Like, your thing is like my literally my favorite product. I'm like, really? Like, what are you doing with it? And he says, well, we got these people, they're salespeople, and they're out on the road. And we got an order system, but the order system only runs in the office on this Oracle database. These guys are out on the road with laptops, which, you know, we're going back to the 90s here. Like, laptops were like newfangled things. He's like, they've got laptops.
Can you believe that?
They can't do an order on the laptop. So what they do is they just write down, and he says a lot of them won't even do it on the laptop. They'll just write it on a piece of paper what the order is. And then they come back and their order configuration thing, they put it in there, figure out what the discounts are and stuff. And then they call the customer, they go back to the customer, give them a price. And so it's really inefficient. Sometimes they make mistakes. He says, so what we do is we took your thing and we wrote a little script on top of it so that they could take the orders on the laptop. And then when they come back, they plug in. And because your thing's got this SQL, it just syncs automatically with the big Oracle database. Oh. And now they don't have to do that. I'm like, oh, that sounds cool. And so I don't have the guts to tell the guy we're going to kill it. But I'm just like, okay, weirdo. Yep. You know, I'm writing it down. And then I did another 20 calls and another 20 guys like, yeah, didn't use it. Didn't know anything about it. And then I got another one. And so the second guy tells me almost the exact same story, except his folks are using these ruggedized devices and they're doing service calls for like electrical stuff. And so they've got this database in-house where they log all the service stuff, but they can't do it on the ruggedized devices because the device doesn't talk to the Oracle database back in headquarters. So what they did was the same thing, wrote a little thing on top of our little thing, put it in the device because it could do that because it was low footprint, blah, 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 ran SQL, do it out in the field, come back, sync up with the thing, the exact same use case. So I was like, oh, wow, so here's another one. So in the end, I talked to 100 and like 90, I don't know what, like 92, 94 of them were just like, we don't even know we have it. And the other five are like, where you will pry this from my cold, dead fingers. It's super valuable. So I'm junior. I go back to the executive team and I'm like, okay, I did the 100 calls and here's what happened. And to the credit of that team, they looked at it and said, well, maybe we run at that other use case.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you think about it, we thought this thing was desktop productivity software. What we're about to do is reposition it as an embeddable database for mobile devices. Like, that is a really, really big change. The way you price that thing is going to be different. Like, I'm going to sell it to your whole sales team, your whole service team. So I'm not going to sell it onesie twosie off the website. This is enterprise sales now. I need a salesperson to go out, sell you 1,000 of these things. So pricing is going to be different. The sales thing is. And so these guys were like, let's try it. So we hired a sales rep. We run this experiment for a month and the guy sells loads of them.
Amazing.
And they were like, okay, this looks good. And so we did this big pivot. The thing took off. We ended up getting acquired by a big database company in the Bay Area, Sybase. They acquired us. And then that division became the growth arm of the entire company. And at its peak, that thing was doing hundreds of millions of revenue a year.
Wow.
And we almost killed it because we didn't know what the thing was.
That's amazing.
And so that really got my curiosity peaked. Like, at the beginning, we didn't change the product that much. All we did was contextualize it in a different way. We just called it something else. We just repositioned it. I didn't even know you called that positioning. Wow. Until we had done it. So I landed the big company and then the big company's like, oh, we got lots of crappy products that don't sell anything. Let's give them to April and then she'll figure out that thing that she did with the other one, you know? And I'm like, we didn't know what we were doing. We just kind of messed around until we got something that worked. So that sort of started me on this journey of this positioning thing could make or break a really great product, but a really, really great product positioned the wrong way looks like a loser.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're to do this properly, how do we do it? Like, what is the actual methodology that we should have used so that we didn't misposition it in the first place? Like, how would we have done that better and not waste 2 years of our time trying to sell this thing that wasn't selling? Like, how should we be doing this? Which, you know, embarked me on like 2-3 years of doing the deep dive on positioning and having 1,000 coffee meetings with smart vice presidents of marketing saying, how do you do it? What do you do in these situations? I'm talking to consultants. I went and did a bunch of courses at universities. And what happened was, what I discovered was that we know what positioning is. It's well-defined. Marketers get what it is. They learn about it in school. We do not have a methodology that is agreed upon for actually doing it. And so I decided I'm going to fix that problem. I'm going to be the person that figures out how to do this methodology thing. And that's going to be my magic trick for the rest of my career. And I did. And it's still my magic trick.
And that's what I love about your approach, though, is that it takes something really intimidating. I think you hear positioning and you see the messaging and positioning house, and you hear stories like this and how positioning can make or break the product.
Yeah.
Then you're like, but how do I actually do that? So yeah, I've actually used your book and created workshops from your book and being able to, you know,
that's
help our own team internally to kind of figure out, hey, here's how we should be going through this and approaching this. So I love that you've been able to take that.
That's so cool.
I was wondering, so obviously Awesome is such an amazing book. Obviously you have touched hundreds of thousands of people and companies and customers for all we know, based on the output of that book and everything that you're sharing. Can you talk a little bit about how that influenced your second book on the sales pitch, which is more about, you know, bringing this to life in the sales pitch? I'd love to hear more about this new book, Ambitions on it. I think it just launched in the fall. Is that correct?
Yeah, it just launched in October. I'm so excited about it. Back when I wrote the first book, I thought I am a one and done kind of a book person. I have one thing that I know anything about, and that's called positioning. And I'm going to write a book on how to do positioning. And that's it. I am not a book writer. I'm an engineer. Nobody runs me writing a book about anything. I'm just going to write this book about this one thing. And then that's it. And here's how it went. So the first book is about this, describing this methodology, step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Here's how you do positioning. And at the very end, there's a chapter on, well, once we have the positioning, how do we test it? And it's my opinion that if you're in a B2B situation, the best way to test positioning is take the positioning, turn it into a sales pitch, and then let's go out and test it with some qualified prospects and see how it lands. And the advantage to testing it that way is you get to do it live. You get to control the customers that are on the receiving end of the pitch. You get a lot of signal from the customer. You know, are they squinching their eyes or are they looking excited or not? In a way that you couldn't if you were just A/B testing messaging, which is where you're testing a whole bunch of things like message design and the landing page and are we getting the right traffic and who knows what. If it's B2B, I got a sales team, I can turn this thing into a sales pitch and I can get a lot of signal in a dozen pitches. I'll know whether or not this thing works. So that's how the book ends. It's like, take the positioning, put it into a sales pitch, test it out, way you go. Now, what I learned... And, you know, I kind of knew this before, but I think I was ignoring the problem. But what I learned is that most companies do not know how to take the positioning and translate it into a sales pitch.
Yeah.
In fact, most companies in B2B have no real structure in their sales pitch at all. Like most sales pitches are kind of a grab bag of junk that has existed since the dawn of time. Nobody knows where the original pitch or how the original pitch got made. Every time the company does a new release or a new something, they throw some slides in and take some slides out and muck around. And there's kind of a group effort of arguing about this pitch deck. And then if you hear what the reps are actually doing in sales calls, it sometimes looks nothing like the pitch deck. So a lot of what you see on sales teams is what they're doing in a first substantive sales call with a qualified prospect is more or less a product walkthrough. Like, here's our product. Here's the major features. Here's what we do. This is the end.
Right.
And there's not a lot of positioning going on there. So we do all this work over on the marketing side, and then it kind of doesn't survive the jump over to sales. So, you know, after I put the first book out, I'm getting a lot of companies come to me and say, look, like, you know, we did the positioning work. It's really good, but we can't figure out how to teach the salespeople how to pitch it. Like, we're having a really hard time figuring out how to make a pitch out of this thing. Now, in the work I do with clients, even before I wrote the first book, if you hired me to do positioning, we would spend the first 2 days working on the component pieces of positioning, and we would spend the last day taking that positioning and turning it into a sales pitch so that we could test it. Mm-hmm. We'd do it all in one exercise. I would never leave without finishing the last bit, which is the sales pitch. And I thought, oh man. And then people were coming to me saying, so how do we do the last bit? And I was like, oh, I'm actually going to.
Otherwise, it just lives on this piece of paper forever or on this whiteboard or doc.
And the marketers are doing a great job taking the value props and using that in their messaging. But sales doesn't know how to tell the story to make it real for a customer. Once it gets passed over to sales, we just kind of lose that thread.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I decided, okay, one more book. Fine. And so the structure I've been using with my clients is the same one I used to use internally when I was a VP marketing, at least for the back half of my career. So at the first part of my career, I didn't worry too much about sales pitches. I didn't think building a sales pitch, I didn't think there was anything to it. A lot of times in the companies I was in, the sales team built their own pitches. It wasn't my job until I went to IBM. And then when I went to IBM, I was launching a product and my boss came in and gave me the binder. And the binder was this thing. It's like 4 inches thick. And he says, this is our 59,000 step process to building the sales pitch at IBM. And I'm like, oh no, this is terrible. And I thought, oh man, this is just like everything else at IBM. We're just over engineering this thing. But after I had built a bunch of pitches with it, I started to see the genius in it. Now this pitch had been built custom. The pitch structure had been built custom in an engagement that they had done with some consultants. And in fact, the consultancy were these guys called the Corporate Executive Board, who are famous for writing a book called The Challenger Sale. And so when they came in, they looked at IBM, they looked at the stuff they were selling, and they came up with this pitch deck. And so when I was in IBM, I was using this pitch structure, and I kept thinking, after a while, I thought, this actually works really good. But I don't know if it would ever work outside IBM. Like there's a bunch of stuff in there that like it assumes the deal is ginormous because we only do ginormous deals at IBM, things like that. Anyways, when I left IBM, I landed at a startup and I was brand new and the VP sales was brand new too. And I knew the guy from a previous job. So we worked through the new positioning. And then we were done the new positioning. He said, look, we're going to have to build a new sales pitch for this because the sales pitch we got is terrible. So he and I sat down. I hauled out the binder that I had stolen from IBM and said, I think we should try to steal some of this stuff. And so we took that IBM pitch structure and startupified it. So we took a bunch of stuff out of the middle that you wouldn't do, but we stole some of the key concepts. And then we built a pitch for this thing, which was awesome. And it was so awesome that revenue grew really fast. And 8 months later, we got acquired by IBM.
Oh my God. How ironic.
And I give them their binder back.
Here's my two-step process that we got here. Oh, that's
anyway, so after that, every company I went to, when we did the positioning work, we would then do this sales pitch. So that's how I started doing it in my workshops. And then I decided, you know what? I think there's a lot of ways to build a sales pitch that work. But most teams are not building a sales pitch in a deliberate way. It does not follow a deliberate structure with a deliberate arc. It's not oriented around the product's differentiated value. Most sales pitches do not answer the question, why pick us over the other guys? Most sales pitches are oriented around answering the question, why pick us, period. Mm-hmm. But a customer in a sales pitch, they do not care about that. They do not care that you solve XYZ pain. All your competitors do too. What they want to know is why pick you over everybody else? I got three on the short list. They all look good. Why you over the other guys? And so my sales pitch structure is designed to answer that question. So anyways, the second book is that. So basically I took that structure methodology, spent a year or so figuring out how to write it down and teach it to people in book format. And so the sales pitch book is that. It's, you know, here's how I build a pitch. There's 8 piece parts to it. Here's how you map positioning to those piece parts. And then, you know, here's how you test it and roll it out. So that's what the second book is about. I'm pretty excited about it.
I'm excited about it too. Well, congratulations again. Thank you. Awesome. All right. I have a couple of hot takes for you. So just
quick
fire answers.
I know people always give me the hot takes on podcasts and they're like, what's your favorite TV show? And I'm like, I don't watch TV.
These are more related to product marketing.
But... yeah, good. I like those better.
All right. So what role should AI play in product marketing?
I get this one all the time now because everybody's really, really excited about AI and the potential for AI to change things. And, you know, there's a handful of things that I think should get much better with AI, maybe not necessarily now, but in the future. Like, we should be able to get much better information from sales about what's going on in actual sales calls. For example, we're now recording everybody's sales conversations. I should be able to figure out from analyzing the sales conversations, which competitors come up in the deal and who should I be positioning against? That should be an easy question to answer. If I had everything in, recorded in Gong and I had the right AI tools, I should be able to say, who are my number one, two, three competitors that come up in deals? What is the status quo in my account typically? And then break that down by market segment. Like, this would be amazing information to have. Now, it's not like we can't get that today. If I've got good, experienced salespeople, I can pull it out of them. But it would be neat to have the data to back that up. That would be cool. I'd also be interested in things like objections, right? That again, this is easy stuff. If I'm recording all the Gong calls, I should be able to go in and say, what's my number one objection that we get? What's my number one objection we get in deals we win? What's my number one objection we get in deals that we lose? If you read, I don't know if you've read Matt Dixon. So the guy who wrote The Challenger Sale released a book last year, the year before, called The Jolt Effect. Yeah. And what he did in that book was at the beginning of COVID, when everyone switched to staying at home and nobody's on the road anymore, he worked with a handful of companies and they used AI to analyze 2.5 million sales calls. And the data and insights he got out of that is fascinating. Like, everybody should read this book. And so ever since I've read that book, I just kept thinking, man, like, there's 9,000 other questions I want to ask that 2.5 million sales calls. But most companies don't have the volume of data to be able to do that. But I think at some point we will. And then this will be a neat thing for us to analyze. Where I'm less optimistic about AI is in doing things that requires real insight about the market and how customers behave. And, you know, that people will say, well, can't we just do positioning? You know, can't we just load April's stuff into a chat bot and have the April chat bot? And then that thing would just do positioning for us. And the answer is no, man, not even close. Like, it's so bad. I don't even want to talk about it. It's so bad. So, you know, we don't know. There's so much information that we could get if we had a cross-functional team together where we had, here's what sales knows about the customer. Here's what product knows about the customer. Here's what marketing knows about the customer. Here's what the founder knows about the customer together in a room. Like, that's going to beat AI all day, every day. I don't know if AI is ever going to catch up to that. So there's some things that I'm super excited about and other things that I'm like, people, we're at the peak of inflated expectations right now with AI, right? People are seeing the potential in all kinds of things. The reality is going to be different. And I think a year from now, people will be having these conversations and they'll sound very different because we'll know what the limitations of this stuff actually is.
Totally agree. One more hot take on you for you. What do you wish you knew then that you know now? So what do you wish you knew maybe at the beginning of your career that you wish you knew now? Wish you knew then.
Yeah. You know, at the beginning of my marketing career, I thought my worth as a marketer, like how I would get judged as a marketer, would be on my ability to really nail tactics. So I thought, you know, like if we're doing email stuff, I got to be the queen of email. I got to know all this stuff inside, outside, backwards. How does email marketing work and how to do all this stuff, tactical stuff. And I got really, really concerned about tactical stuff in the early part of my career. And then what you learn when you're old, right, is that tactics, man, they come and go. And there's always some new tactical thing that everybody's like, remember voice search? Remember how crazy we were about voice search? Like, these things come and then they go and then there's, you know, whatever. But there are a bedrock set of things that don't change all that much in marketing. And if you get really good at those, they're applicable everywhere you go. So figuring out how to get good market insight figuring out how to really understand a market and your company's place in that market. Like, these things are not tactical things. They're quite strategic. So I wish I had spent less time worried about marketing and more time worrying about markets. Like, And so if I were to go back to my younger self, I would have said, don't stress so much. Like, you know, if I think back to this stuff I was working on at the beginning, we were doing print advertising. And I was trying to get really good at print advertising. I go back and say, April, you can forget about that print advertising stuff. You know, you don't have to be good at that.
I love that. Go away.
We're not going to worry about it.
The market's not the marketing. That's
market's not marketing. Don't worry so much about the tactical stuff. Worry about the big picture stuff. Can you pull it up, the big picture stuff? If you get good at that, that's what they want the VP marketing thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Amen. All right. Well, last question for you. Besides buying your fabulous books or listening to your podcast, how can our listeners reach you? Would you recommend your newsletter? Or how can they get in the world?
Sure. So I'm a low-key newsletter writer these days. I publish one every few weeks when I'm feeling the urge. So yeah. So if you go, aprildunford.com is my website. If you go on there, if you go aprildunford.com/books, and you scroll down a little bit, you can sign up for the newsletter and you'll get a couple of things. As there's some bait to get you to sign up for the newsletter, which is a bunch of templates that go with the books. And so if you're working on this stuff internally, I think the templates are cool. So you could try that and sign up for the newsletter. I have this podcast. And again, I'm sort of low key on the podcast thing, but it's called Positioning with April Dunford. You can go look at that. I'm not that active on social media, but LinkedIn is the only one that I pay any attention to. So you can follow me on LinkedIn. And if I have a new podcast or a new newsletter or something popping out, you'll see me yakking about it on LinkedIn. So if you want the low key follow, you can do that.
Thank you, April. Well, this has been so much fun for me personally. I don't think I've laughed so much during a podcast.
We're supposed to be having fun with this stuff.
We should be. Well, thanks again for being part of the show. Really appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you.
Women in Product Marketing is a Sharebird show, the site where leading product marketing execs answer questions and share best practices, including myself and our podcast guests. Sharebird makes it easy to search thousands of answers from the very best product marketers in the world around your daily challenges so you can get better outcomes. And the best part is it's free to join. Visit sharebird.com today.